Now, at this point, we're going to take up where we left off last month. That, of course, was June. And we're beginning with Book 2, The Dark Night. We're going to skip Chapter 15. It's very brief. But we're going to take up Chapter 16. And here our saint, that's St. John of the Cross, is describing how a person traveling through this period of purification walks securely, even though they're in darkness, and they're not sure just where they're at with God. This is the way the Lord works. He puts it in a poem, and we're reading the second stanza. We explained the first the last time. It reads, "In darkness and secure, by the secret ladder disguised, ah, the sheer grace, in darkness and concealment, my house being now all stilled." If you know Spanish, it should be read in the Spanish, because his poetry is considered some of the greatest poetry ever written in Spain. Now, to explain the words here, the darkness a person experiences in the first night, we describe two nights. The first one dealt with the outer part of us. That's the body with the senses, five senses, eye, ears, touch, taste, and smell. And then the inner sense life, we call that the imagination, the sense memory, emotional life, our body appetites. The darkness that a person experiences in the first night of the senses affects these senses and the inner faculties of imagination, memory, the emotions, the spiritual appetites, and the faculties. By depriving them of their natural fulfillment, their light, we would say, they in time become illumined supernaturally. Sense and spiritual appetites are, as it were, put to sleep, deadened. The darkness also ties up the imagination, prevents it from doing any work, especially during prayer. Memory, too, is affected by it, unable to retain or remember anything. The intellect is darkened and not able to understand anything presented to it. That's not all the time, but there are periods like that. And so the will becomes dry and bound. All the faculties become empty and, as it were, useless. It seems to this person that a heavy cloud hangs over him and afflicts him. It seems to separate him from God. Yet, this person here affirms that he walks securely in darkness. Now let's explain that. A person usually does not commit a fault unless it be through one of the appetites, senses, through their gratification, or through one's knowledge or desires and emotions. You get angry, get impatient, say things that hurt, and so forth. Here, a person ordinarily fails through either defect or excess. He fails because of their inordinate attractions. If all these activities and movements are hindered, then a person is free from fault, free from what binds him within himself, enslaves him, and also is free from his enemies, the world and the devil. The devil, because he usually tempts a person through his senses and his feelings and emotions, appetites. When these are deadened, the devil cannot trouble that person. So to the degree the soul walks in this darkness and emptiness in its natural activities, to that degree does it walk securely. Once these evils or the faults of the person are prevented, the blessings of union with God are granted to the faculties and appetites. Our Carmelite mystic writes it in these words, "These appetites and faculties become divine and heavenly in their union." Now, on close observation, this person will notice that the faculties and appetites are seldom distracted by useless and harmful objects, that they are secure from self-complacency, pride, presumption, from vain and empty joy, from many other harmful things. While the soul avoids these dangers, it also makes rapid progress because it is being exercised in all the virtues. All they're very much aware of is darkness. frustration, emptiness, as though they were dead regarding their feelings. But if they're at all observant, they'll notice that they're not attracted by things of the world. That's a big burden from the Spirit. That's a relief. But the other is, where is my God? Hey, that's the other burden. Well, the question now is, why does the soul experience difficulty with the things of God more so than with other things in its appetites and faculties? It seems to receive no blessing in these good things of God during this dark night, like prayer. Prayer becomes a terrible ordeal, but it has a hunger for it, because there's an inner attraction, and that attraction is God within, who is constantly drawing the soul like a magnet, but it doesn't sense that in a real conscious way. Now, the answer to that question is, at this time, this person's appetites and faculties are very much bound up in things that are very natural, of a low order, and even somewhat sinful. We're talking about the person needs to be purified, and God brings him into this night. So there should not be any activity or satisfaction concerning spiritual objects for that person. They're too drawn to outward things yet. Now, if God were to give the soul the benefit of enjoying the activity and delight of supernatural divine things, the faculties would not be able to receive them with all the purity needed, but only in a very base and natural way. A philosophical principle that we can use to explain that is, whatever is received by a person is received according to the mode of the receiver. Now, put into a practical example would mean this. Two people look at a famous painting, will receive that painting in different ways. See? Let's say a farmer doesn't know anything about painting. He looks at it and he says, blah. But then you get a real artist who knows all the strokes and the master touches that need to be put into that painting. And he looks at a painting by Raphael or Michelangelo or Da Vinci, and he's just in admiration. Now, he sees far more. So whatever is received from the painting is received according to the orientation, the background of the receiver. You get the point now. During this dark night, these senses, faculties, appetites are transformed and prepared for the exalted experience and taste of the great blessings and transforming union that will be granted, but not until the old man, and as you've heard me say, the old lady, has died and their ways have been changed. No matter how much work we work at the spiritual improvement of ourselves, no matter how much fulfillment we receive from this kind of activity, unless this activity is first blessed by God and initiated by Him, our saint says that that person so activated will not experience God's blessings in a spiritual and divine way. In other words, in that experience. The experience will only be in a human, natural way. No matter how much we try to pray, we cannot put ourselves on God's level. He must come down and take the action. All we do is say, Lord, I'm here, I'm waiting, humbly, confidently, trusting, and when He thinks it's fine, then He'll step in. In the meantime, we should perseveringly pray as well as we can. The mystical doctor holds that, quote, if the soul in its interior acts is to be moved by God divinely, it must first be obscured, in other words, put in this darkness, put to sleep, pacified in regard to its natural ability and operations, so that these operations might weaken, not get in the way. That's why the imagination, for example, becomes difficult to control. God, as it were, pushes it aside. Imagination is not needed when we deal with God. He doesn't fit into a picture. He's pure spirit. So our saint encourages the person who is being purified in his appetites and desires, and being purified, say, with dryness and emptiness, finds his faculties unable to perform their operations, thinking about some truth in the gospel and so on, he encourages them to think of this as a blessing, because God is liberating him from himself, and God is taking over the activity himself. Another reason why the soul travels securely and is blessed is that it moves on a new path. A path that's unknown to it makes it feel that it's lost, while in fact is growing in holiness and gaining great spiritual profit. Take the example of a man who wants to travel to a new unknown country, travels over unknown roads, so his knowledge is of no help to him. He must depend on the guidance of someone else, or if a person wants to learn or grow in a skill in some art or trade, he must depend on someone else, not on his own knowledge. So on the path to union with God, God is the master and guide, while the soul remains in blindness and follows. While it is in darkness, it is really secure. The darkness is a cover, and we'll explain more of that. Another reason for this security: during this time, this person advances by suffering. The saint writes, "Suffering is a surer and even more advantageous road than that of joy and action." Very hard for us to endure God when he purifies, but that's the best time for us. But we don't see it that way. When a soul suffers, God gives it strength. But when it is active in deeds and joys of its own weakness and imperfections are much in evidence. When we do something, we see the effects of it, then two things can happen, depending on where we are with God. We can glorify God, and it's good for us, or we can become proud of it, then it hurts us. Okay? Like somebody who has some charismatic gift, like the gift of healing, he can touch people and they're healed, and he could be saying, I've ready to have my halo here. Do you see my wings? And where does that put him? The bottom of the totem pole with God. It's not helping him. See? God is glorified, but he is not better for it. So that kind of activity, the Lord, as it were, takes out of their way at this time. Now, in a time of suffering, the virtues are practiced much more than at other times, and they're acquired more perfectly while the soul is purified, becomes more careful, and made wiser. Although we dread suffering, it's good for us. Another reason: the very darkness that enshrouds the soul is actually a light, or what our saint calls an obscure wisdom, a dark contemplation, and it brings the soul so close to God that it protects and frees the soul from all that is not God. The only cure for this soul and its health is God. And he puts it on a diet that removes the soul from all things. It loses its desire for the things of this life. While the contemplation is dark, this seeming obscurity is a safeguard and a loving concern for the soul. Being weak, the spiritual person senses a thick darkness and a greater inner obscurity as he comes closer to God. In the same way, a person feels the closer he comes to the overwhelming brilliance of the sun. If you keep looking at the sun, all you see is darkness. And the closer you get to the sun, if you ever dare, then the darker it'll be, because it overpowers the eye. But it doesn't mean you're distant from the sun. Means you're closer to the sun. So when the human spirit gets close to God, it produces the same spiritual effect. At this time, the spiritual light is so bright and so great that it blinds and darkens the light of the natural intellect as it invades the spirit. How blind we really are spiritually. What in truth is clearest and most true are for us what is most dark and doubtful. So we run away from them and from what is best for us. But we do embrace what is most satisfying to our senses and desire, and want what is the worst thing for us, and so we constantly fall. So how true it is that The soul is secure and protected and close to God in this time of darkness. It serves as a perfect protection for the soul, from itself and from the harm of others. And a final reason for this word secure. It's noticeable at least to the spiritual director, and even to the soul itself, that it has a strong determination to serve God faithfully, and not to offend Him in anything. While there is a darkness, it still refreshes and strengthens the soul in what is good for it, although there is a darkness and pain. The hidden love in the soul fills it with a great vigilance and an inner concern as to what it should do to please God or not do. The hidden contemplation being given to this person detaches the appetites, faculties, senses from all things, leads it to reserve its strength and effort only for giving God the worship and the glory that is due Him. Now, in that poem, he used the word secret. Why is this kind of prayer, it's called a dark contemplation, called secret? He says, by a secret ladder, disguised. This night has three characteristics indicated in the words secret, ladder, and disguised. The dark contemplation is called secret because theologians call it secret wisdom, which St. Thomas says is granted and infused into the soul through love. It is secret and unknown to the intellect and the other faculties because they do not work to attain it. Just like you, for example, will. How did you attain your skill in cooking? By reading countless books and burning a lot of food. Now, this person, though, comes by a supernatural wisdom, doesn't come from books, comes from God. It's, in other words, is given. It's the presence of the Holy Spirit activating the gift of wisdom, which all of us have, but in this person is very operative. This wisdom is infused by the Holy Spirit into the soul, and the person does not know or understand how it's done. So the reason for calling it secret. Nor does the devil understand this, nor anyone else, because God dwells within the soul in depths where the devil, the senses, or the intellect cannot reach. You and I sometimes have an experience of that. Way down deep within us, there is an area we call the deepest part of our being. Our mind, our intellect, our understanding intellect cannot reach there. We can become aware of it, though, at times. And that's where God is. Only at times are there flashes of that presence that we experience in our imagination or intellect or in our feelings, like in the baptism of the Spirit event, or a personal encounter with God in love. But He's always there. This is what we're talking about in that area. This contemplation is also called secret because the effects it produces in the soul cannot be put into words. This wisdom of love is communicated in the first night of the senses and also in the advanced stage. And although it is more clear to the soul then, it remains inexpressible. No words can be found to describe the sublime understanding, the delicate spiritual feeling bestowed on the spirit. The interior wisdom does not come to the person through the intellect dressed up in some sense image or ideas. So the imagination cannot form any picture of it. At the same time, the soul is very conscious of the fact that it does understand and taste this delightful and wonderful wisdom. Here, the language of God is far above everything of the senses and places a complete silence on all the soul's faculties because it is very spiritual and intimate to the soul. This is the reason why some persons who want to give an account of their spiritual state to their spiritual director are not able to describe it. All they can say is, I'm at peace. That's it. But if they knew this, they could put a lot of words into it. But they don't. They feel a great unwillingness to speak about their prayer because this contemplation is very simple. and they are hardly aware of it. All they can say is they are at peace, happy, fulfilled, aware of God's presence, always well. But when the communications are of a particular kind, in other words, before this now, it's only a general impression of God's presence. God is God. Not God is merciful, is loving, is whatever. But God is God, that's all. But now, if there is some particular truth being given to this person, like a vision, or words, we call it revelation, or holy spiritual feelings, they are received through some idea or image, and so they can be described. But pure contemplation cannot be put into words, so it is secret. This mystical wisdom is called secret because it hides the soul within itself. Our saint describes it in these words. Occasionally, this mystical wisdom will so engulf a person in its secret abyss that he will have the keen awareness of being brought into a place far removed from every creature, that has been led into a remarkably deep and vast wilderness, unattainable by any human creature, into an immense, unbounded desert. The more delightful, savorous, and loving it is, the deeper, vaster, and more solitary it is. Now, having experienced this sublime, exalted wisdom, leading, say, to the science of love, the spiritual person realizes that everything else in comparison is base. All words utterly fail to express divine things, no matter how wisely or brilliantly one speaks about them. So it is rightly called secret. Remember St. Paul saying, I know a man taken to the third heaven, and he couldn't describe it. This contemplation is secret and above a person's natural ability because it is the path that leads the soul to perfect union with God. And the soul travels this road by ignorance or unknowing and by the special assistance of the Holy Spirit. As this contemplation guides the soul to God, the path is a road that is unknown to our senses. So it's called secret wisdom. Now, why does he use the word ladder? In other words, this secret wisdom is also kind of ladder. There are many reasons for calling it a ladder. First, just as one climbs a ladder to some high place where treasure is hidden, so by this secret contemplation, the soul ascends into the world of the Spirit, the world of God, in order to know and possess the blessings and treasures of heaven. God is that treasure. A ladder is used not only to ascend, but also to descend. So by the ladder of this secret contemplation, the soul is first exalted in God and also humiliated within itself. This is a sign of all true communications from God. Namely, they both exalt and they humble the person. As Jesus says in the Gospel, he who humbles himself will be exalted. He who exalts himself will be humbled. Luke 14:11. If the spiritual person is observant, as he travels this road, he will notice that he suffers many ups and downs. After some time of blessing and consolation, there will be a time of trial and temptation. Peace and plenty follow a time of misery and torment with regularity until one arrives at the state of quiet. So there is a constant ascension and descension. And the spiritual person never remains in one state for too long. Now, the reason for this experience is that the state of perfection is a state of perfect love of God and detachment from self. It cannot exist without both a knowledge of God and a knowledge of self. So before this state of perfection can be achieved, the person must be practiced in both kinds of knowledge. This process goes on until perfect habits have been acquired, and the soul has reached God in a permanent union of love. One who is knowledgeable of this process will notice that the person being purified will consider the time when he suffers the painful time of detachment, dryness, and darkness. He considers them as the worst for him. Whereas, when he is consoled and fulfilled, a time that may not be as great in value as a time of suffering, because one may be attached to the sweetness, he considers such a time as the best. That's not the way God sees it. In actual fact, time of suffering is the best. See, but our senses say, no, never, never, never. Get rid of it. Now, the main reason for calling contemplation a ladder is that it is a science of love, an infused loving knowledge that both enlightens and fills the soul with love, lifting it up one step at a time to God. There are, we're going to explain shortly, 10 steps in this ladder of love, and we're briefly going to explain the signs and the effects as a person moves from one step to the other. Both St. Bernard and St. Thomas have given a description of these effects. So we're going to take first the first 5 steps. On the first step of love, a person experiences what is called a sickness of love. Well, anybody that's known human love knows what that is. That's what they call heart trouble. Here the soul languishes for the sake of God himself and has a dislike for sin, anything that is not God or that does not lead to him. Here the spiritual person changes the ways of his past life and loses the desire for all things. This kind of spiritual sickness does not come to a person unless it comes from God, from the Lord. Under the influence of this blessing, the soul cannot find any happiness, support, fulfillment, or peace in anything but the Lord. Then it moves on to the second step. On the second step, the kind of love here makes a person seek God constantly, pay no attention to anything until it finds the Lord. Now, Mary Magdalene in the Gospels is a good example of such a person, paid no attention even to the angels at the tomb as she sought the Lord. And you remember the words, where have you taken him? Let me know and I'll take him away. She never thought about the trouble she'd have carrying a dead body. So the soul on the second step seeks the Lord with great concern, focusing all its thoughts on the Beloved. Whether in conversation or in business routine, it thinks of him and speaks of him, whether eating, sleeping, or in prayer, vigil, or doing anything else. All its care is centered on the Beloved. As the soul grows in love on this step, it begins to move up to the third step, but along with a new purifying period in the night of the Spirit. Here, on the third step now, love urges the soul to step out and perform good works, and gives it a spiritual fervor. That means real enthusiasm and zeal to do things for God. And it helps it to persevere and not fail in its efforts. The fire of love burns so brightly and deeply in this soul that it thinks its works, no matter how great, are quite small. And no matter how many, are just few. No matter how long a time spent in their performance, that the time is short. The love can be so intense that the person feels a deep sorrow, even a pain, about the little that he seems to be doing for God. It may reach such a point that he would gladly destroy himself with great penances, many times over for the Lord, if that were pleasing to God and were permitted. It's true. At this time, with that kind of love, person would really kill themselves with penances, any kind. This may be the reason why, if you read the lives of some saints, they did extraordinary penances. But in this, we're not to imitate them. They probably had discernment, although I wouldn't canonize all the penances some of the saints did. Some of them were probably imprudent. So he thinks that all his works are useless and his life of little worth. In other words, in comparison with the knowledge he has of God, the beauty, how lovable God is, how good he has been, merciful and so forth, all that in comparison with the little that he does. Another effect noticeable here is that he thinks that he's actually worse than everyone else. One reason for this is that love is teaching him what God really deserves. Also, while he performs many good works for the Lord, he knows they are quite imperfect, so he is in confusion and pain over them. He's very conscious of the fact that his works are so far beneath so great a God. Here, the person is free from any self-complacency, presumption, and the ugly fault of condemning others. So the soul has the courage and strength to move on to the next step, the fourth step, has an habitual suffering that is not wearisome because of its beloved. In other words, love is its own reward, but it also is a burden. What may be heavy and burdensome for others is not so for this person, because love makes it easy. Like the little boy saying, carrying his brother. He's not heavy, he's my brother. It has so much energy now that the flesh is brought into control and little concern is shown for it, that the soul does not seek consolation either in God or anything else, doesn't ask for it, nor does it seek or ask for favors of God, because it's deeply aware of the many favors it has already received from him. That's true. In other words, they've been so blessed. All concern is directed to pleasing the Lord in whatever service is at hand. This kind of love is very exalted. It leads a person to pursue God, and it suffers for his sake. For this reason, the good Lord gives that person a new joy as he visits it with spiritual delight. Jesus' love for us cannot endure such manifestations of love without responding to them. Here, the soul neither stops nor rests in anything, but moves on in a state of interior detachment from everything. And such love leads on then to the fifth step, and this is called an impatient love and longing for God. The desire of the soul to be united with the beloved is so burning that any delay, however slight, is too long, annoying, and tiresome. It is always filled with the expectation of finding its beloved, but sees its desire unfulfilled at every step, and this makes it faint with longing. On this fifth step, St. John of the Cross says, the loving soul must, quote, either see its beloved or die. On this step, the soul is fed so much on love that it moves on finally to the sixth step. And this is where we'll stop in our first conference. I'd like to have some discussion, if we can, on this, unless you feel you're so spaced out. Excuse me, that you're out in space. I didn't provide you with space suits, so I imagine you're in a rarefied atmosphere here. So we'll have to bring you down and provide you with oxygen. But have any question?
Yes, thank you. Do you think that the highs and lows of our emotional life are similar to the spiritual highs and lows you're speaking of?
No. I'm not talking about people who are very emotionally immature. They have a lot of ups and downs. A person that is what we would call rather normal, in other words, there are times we have flashes of impatience and of anger, but they're not every day, and we can handle them. This kind of up and down is quite noticeable. And in other words, there are times of consolation, of joy, and just pure delight. Then the next week, you know, down in the pits, back to the salt mines again. And One simply has to endure that. In other words, it's the Lord's way of saying, I want you to learn to be detached and know that when I console you, that it may come to an end, and it's not me, really. See? God is above all these things. These are only little effects of Him. So we're to be attached to the giver, not so much to the gift. And this is the way the Lord prepares a person for that kind of detachment. Doesn't mean He doesn't give them any delight at all. As you know here, after this is over, it's all next thing to heaven. You know? The love that experience is so great that it would die if God didn't modify it. Pure delight and joy. And this is for all of us. But there's a course we have to travel. Yes.
It's really dark as far as God is concerned, but you pray and it's He's not there.
Seemingly not there.
Right, and you there's nothing that you feel or receive from that prayer, and goes on, and then for no reason at all, for anything you do, it changes. And when you do pray, that there's an abundance.
Yes, that's part of this, what we're explaining here.
Not to anything that you do or circumstances or anything.
That's right. Anyone else?
You said there's nothing that the person does himself. This is all God at work. Okay. Is there anything that a person can do? To interfere.
Yes.
With what God is doing.
They could.
And I don't mean out and out sin.
They could turn to worldly things. And the early stages of this. Yes. The early stages of this process, they could, as he says, in the early stages, when this dryness sets in, day after day, you know, prayers, not much of a delight anymore. It's just drudgery. One seems to be doing nothing, getting nowhere. Faults seem to be multiplying. Their emotional life is upset in different ways. Things seem to be happening. That's when their endurance and perseverance is tested. When they must not go back and just, you know, return to a worldly way, which may not be quite sinful, but it would be in this case for this person to some extent. Because it is now being led by God, being blessed in a very special way. And to refuse that would be wrong. So, in other words, they go back to reading all kinds of paperbacks, just wasting time in useless conversation, a lot of TV, yes, endless TV, you know, frittering away the time. And thing that would appeal to the senses, but not to the spirit. That would be death to this process. And some do that. Some are not that strong, or they don't have the direction they want or need, or they're so confused that they or Satan may step in. And there's a no man's land here, and a number of things can happen. The big word is perseverance. All kinds of people are being blessed with prayer, but they may spend 1 year at it, then after that they get back to their old ways. Thing is to stay in there all the time, not once a week or once a month or once every 2 weeks, but every day, and maybe an hour a day. And more.
Is it at this time when prayer becomes really a burden?
Yes.
I'm even burdened to go to Mass.
See, prayer is not a burden for a person who prays 1 hour a week.
Yeah.
But if you pray 1 hour a day, that's like carrying 100 pounds, especially if it's dry and difficult. And then all kinds of things hit you at that time. That's That's when prayer becomes a furnace. The prayer is never the same all the time. I mean, real prayer. At a time like that, prayer is the furnace of God. So you kind of walk into the crucible and you're not that ready to do that all the time.
When a person would go back into the world, as you said, you know, the senses, TV or something, do they, when they return back to prayer, you know, it can happen that they can return back to prayer. You know, return.
Yes.
And
Teresa of Avila did that after 20 years. She was given contemplation in the early part of her religious life. But she was a great conversationalist. You know, she liked to talk. She'd talk your ear off. And she regretted it. And then God gave her a picture of where her place in hell was, and it scared the hell out of her. And she really got down to pray. And then God did something with her. And she became the wonderful person we know her to be. Well, we don't know. Things would have to be considered there. In other words, is a person doing something wrong? What could they be doing that might get into God's way? And if they can find nothing, then the assumption would be that it's God's working. And it's a time for them just to, the word is, endure it. There are some saints who spent 30 years in dryness. And that particular saint is Saint Jane Frances de Chantal, foundress of the Visitandine nuns, visitation nuns. But she was already quite perfect to endure all that. God asked that of her in a very special way. But that's very unusual. If it's God's work, he will not test you beyond your ability. And there will be times like there's an oasis in the desert, we would say. So he'll feed you on dates and coconuts and whatnot. In other words, God's consolations. God is not, in other words, an executioner or a tormentor. Any other question?
Father, can this asset process of getting close to the Lord, the ascent towards God, be cultivated purely by desire?
No. We cannot write the book. The Holy Spirit writes the books. A case where there could be a desire would be a person on his deathbed who would see through God's grace and enlightenment the vanity and the uselessness of his life, then how good and lovable God is. He's just so filled with desire, but it's so pure and unselfish that it's perfect. Could God make him perfect in 1 hour? Sure. Yes. That kind of love could do it. But that's extraordinary. The normal process is that you're in there each day, working away quietly, but it is God usually does the work. We kind of just prepare the way. The more we get out of his way, the better. That doesn't mean, though, the less we do. We've got to pray. We've got to be in there being what God wants us to be where we're at. A good father, a good mother, a good husband, a good wife, a good Christian in your social setting. In other words, you've got to manifest your Christianity. If you never do, then how will people know that you're Christian? So in other words, there are things we've got to do. In other words, to show our goodwill. But the real thing that makes us holy is God's action itself. See? He is the holiness and he shares it with us.
How do you achieve this perfection, Father?
Well, you just say, Lord, take over, be my holiness. Help me today now to be patient, to be kind, to be kind of person you want me to be. Then as you go through your day, try to be that. Let Christ kind of take over. Be another Christ, like Mother Teresa of Calcutta. You don't have to go to the poor like she does, but go to the poor in your family. I mean, go to those in your own family. Be for them. Be Christ to your husband, to your children. That's achieving perfection. Sal?
I was reading something this morning, I think it was, having to do with the ladder. And while your teaching was emphasizing progress, you know, towards God, what struck me was the things that, you know, we think we're at a certain point, and how one little step at a time, how all of a sudden we find ourselves at the bottom again, and it's just that, in my case, like I have to keep thinking about it, all the time, that one little step may not sound like, well, like the sister said, it may not be sin, but it may be maybe watching a TV program instead of reading my Bible. There's something very, very small, or something that I have omitted to do, and how suddenly just